you know, they're human beings, and you're sort of sitting there saying, okay, so why are you investing in this? And they're going, well, because it gets me returns. Hmm. And you're like, do you actually know what that company does? Slowly the conversation sort of starts to move, and most of the time people just don't want to hear it, and the conversation sort of stops there. But sometimes they will say, actually, I'd love to bring my grandson here and he can learn a bit about what these companies are doing. And you sort of bring the next generation in to the conversation, and the cogs start turning in the lead investor's mind of, yeah, maybe I do want to invest a bit more ethically. I did work with some charities too, but I found that it was, yeah, really painful experiencing their reliance on donations and philanthropic giving. It just felt like half the year they were spending time on trying to get money.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at procurementexpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Lucy Dunnett from Safari and Yoga. And Lucy and I are going to talk about something that we both have experience with, which is working with African companies and staff in Africa. And more particularly, we're going to be discussing an interview we found online, which is going to be linked below, between Rory Stewart, who is a UK-based ex-MP, who is, I believe, the director of Give Directly, which is a charity, and Bob Geldof, famous Irish entrepreneur, and also now private equity empresario. So Lucy has a background in private equity and finance, rather finance, and as such, she's kind of the perfect person to ask about Bob's private equity firm and whether it's really a force for good or evil in the world. So Lucy, thanks very much for coming along. Maybe you could just give us an introduction to yourself, where you are, a little bit about you and your background before we get stuck in.
Intro to me, I am a mother to three children, but I also run a business called Safari and Yoga, where I take groups of business people or individuals and families out to Africa and take them on once-in-a-lifetime experiences where they get to really connect with nature, slow down, shut off their worrying minds, come into their bodies, and kind of experience something that's really unique for themselves, and then take that change that they've experienced within back home into their businesses, into their personal lives, into their families. I feel it's such an honor to be part of this project because it is really nice to hear from people how these experiences change their lives.
That's a worthy mission, and a project's very interesting. We're going to talk about it a little bit later on, but you didn't start off in your commercial life with such lofty goals. You were doing what in London?
Yeah, I was doing wealth management and investment banking in London for 10 years in finance. Yeah, it was an incredible learning journey for me. Stepped straight out of uni into this sort of big city life in London, having grown up in Wales in the middle of a field. Yeah, it was fascinating, but it really, after like 10 years doing it, it really kind of started affecting me because there's a lot of focus on money and power, and I was working within sustainability and trying to encourage investors to move money into sustainable assets, but it was tiny, tiny tweaks. And it just felt very, very slow, this movement of assets from kind of the less sustainable assets into the more sustainable assets. And fair enough, you know, investors just preferred to be with the status quo, what they knew, where they knew returns were going to come from. So it was hard work. So I realized I wanted to move into something where I was having more impact. So I moved into working with social entrepreneurs and helping them to create strategies to grow their businesses, and also to connect them to investors who could invest in them and help them to scale.
I'm interested. So you went into sort of finance in London, wealth management, I guess, dealing with sort of private banking, I guess, helping people with their investment decisions, or was it at a corporate level?
Yeah, it was at a private level, so individuals.
It sounds like a glamorous world. I've met a couple of people across the years who've done that, and they live a very otherworldly existence for the most part, chatting around the place. Let's be honest, like, that sounds kind of attractive. All of the, you know, white tablecloth dinners and meetings in Switzerland and so on. But did you go into it with a view that you were you were on a mission, you already knew what you were going to do, or was it just like sounded like cool to be flying in these circles?
To be honest with you, I think I just was like, I need a job after uni. And right. I happened to be quite good at maths and spreadsheets and stuff. And, you know, I went to a few interviews and it seemed to be something that I could do. So, right. Yeah, that was the first thing. And then once I was in it and I was meeting these families and, you know, some of them were corporations, you know, big charitable organizations with massive endowment funds are also investing their assets, and also big companies who have massive investments. So that there were some corporations, but mostly families. But you meet these individuals and, you know, they're human beings, and you're sort of sitting there saying, okay, so why are you investing in this? You know, what is it that's making you? And they're going, well, because it gets me returns. Hmm. And you're like, do you actually know what that company does? Slowly the conversation sort of starts to move. And most of the time people just don't want to hear it. And the conversation sort of stops there. But sometimes, yeah, they will say, actually, I'd love to bring my, you know, grandson here and he can learn a bit about what these companies are doing. And you sort of bring the next generation in to the conversation, and the cogs start turning in the lead investor's mind of, yeah, maybe I do want to invest a bit more ethically. Maybe I want to be monitoring what I'm investing in a bit more. So it was quite an organic process for me. I wasn't sort of a complete saint to start with. I mean, I was all big into sort of save the planet and sustainability when I was at uni, but that, I think that was everyone. It wasn't just me. I mean, people always think these like big investors with loads of money are so different, but they're really not. They're just like everyone else. They just happen to have worked incredibly hard. And, or, you know, I had a sort of 23-year-old tech entrepreneur who sold his business to an AI company and suddenly found himself with loads of money. And, you know, they're just quite normal people. And they're thinking, gosh, what am I going to do with this? Can you support me to make a strategy for my family and for my future? And maybe I'd like to do something philanthropically on the side. But yeah, it's hard to move money into sustainable assets when people are really only looking at returns.
Well, you hit on something. I'd like to ask you about that. There's a difference between having a large pot of money. Like, let's say you have an exit, you have a big pot of money, and then it's only going one way, basically. You know, it's finite, basically, and you're just trying to make sure you don't run out of money before you die. And I've heard people who know those very wealthy people, but it affects their mindset in that it's kind of almost, they go from a growth mindset, so they may have, you know, been running a business and doing things, and then suddenly, once it's over and they just have a pot of money they're staring at, it takes over their life. They get sort of paranoid. Is that fair, or have you seen that happen?
I definitely came to the conclusion while I was there that I didn't want to have lots of investable assets myself because it does make you paranoid, I think. Yeah, for sure. But I guess it depends what type of person you are. If you're kind of a fear-driven person, the super wealthy are worried about their kids getting kidnapped everywhere they go. And
That's not life.
There's just so many things to worry about. If you own loads of expensive art, you're more likely to get someone trying to get into your house while you're away from it. You know, that's just sort of one of those things. So for sure, yeah, there was that. I think the most difficult thing to come up against was when people had quite a lot already. And as a family, they were kind of arguing over who gets what. And it made me realize that the money itself was irrelevant. It was about the fairness and the ego and me being more important and me needing more because I've got X, Y, and Z problems. And it's like people just lose sense of their connection to each other because money just creates these wars between people. So it was, you know, often when a family member would die and you'd go through this probate and inheritance process, and then suddenly you get calls from like the cousins and the things and all the people that were connected to that person who died. You think, funny that they've never mentioned you the whole time they've been a client.
Let's wrap up that chapter by just asking a question, which is, what's the right amount of money to leave to your kids then, do you think? Give them nothing, or what's your takeaway? Will you be leaving money to your kids? And don't worry, they probably won't watch this, so.
I don't know. I think I'd like to do all of that during my life, I think, probably. And I'd rather be spending time with them when I can, when they're young and not earning too much and being connected to them, than worrying too much about what's going to happen when I'm dead.
So you're dodging the question a little bit, because you could have time and money, right? So I'm a dad. I think about this. I was discussing this with my friends at the weekend. I was like, I don't know. Is there like an amount that ruins them? And there's an amount that's just like, cheap them off the streets? You know, do you give them a car? Do you give them a house? Do you give them nothing? You know, having the backup, maybe that's good enough. I feel like that's what my parents gave me. They never really gave me money, but I always knew I could run back to mommy, right? If things went badly.
Yeah, I think in this day and age, one of the hardest things is feeling grounded and settled and having a home. The expense of buying a home is really hard. So I think, the one thing I would rather help them to do is to sort of buy a place where they can feel settled. Yeah, for me, it would be about helping them during their life and during my life to sort of feel like they had their own home that wasn't my home. So they feel like an adult and they can start their own lives. But yeah, I also feel very strongly that if a child has a really great business idea or wants to pursue something creative that's really driving them and motivating them, that they could come to me for support with that financially.
Well, that brings us on to the next chapter, which was you decided, okay, all these squabbling families is too much for me, I'm out of here. And your next step was to try and support entrepreneurs, not well known as the most giving, loving people in the world. Tell me what happened there. What was your next step?
I think I recognized that there's a lot of money out there and there's a lot of people with good ideas who could really do with some money. And I also felt very strongly because I had been in this very corporate environment for 10 years. Mm. And there had been a few people that I'd seen leave their corporate environments and set up their own businesses or join smaller startups who seemed so much happier with so much more freedom, much more excited about life and their career. And so I thought, gosh, if I could help more people to do that, that would be good, and help people to do things that were really meaningful to them and help them to make an impact in their own way. And so, yeah, I guess I sort of supported people to create presentations that investors would read and go, oh, maybe that's worth having a meeting with you, rather right. than kind of looking at it and thinking, yeah, nice dream, and just move on. So I had a really fun time working with organizations like Entrepreneurial Spark, Syndicate Room, which is a crowdfunding platform, Le Ciel's Holistic Visions, Forum for the Future, all kind of inspiring entrepreneurs to grow their businesses and connect with investors. And I did work with some charities too, but I found that it was, really painful experiencing their reliance on donations and philanthropic giving. It just felt like half the year they were spending time on trying to get money, and the rest of the year they could actually do their job. So it was just, it didn't feel sustainable. With that in mind, I definitely resonate a lot with what Bob Geldof has said, because he obviously was working in charity and realized that if a business can become self-sufficient and financially sustainable and can support itself, it can make its own rules and decide when it grows and decide who it hires and when. And it has a lot more flexibility. Whereas if a business or an organization is constantly relying on grants and donations, they never know when they're going to come in. And it can be very, very painful.
Yeah. So this is a fascinating video that we're going to talk about now. Obviously, you sort of set out your credentials there. You've got experience with finance. You've got experience with entrepreneurs. And we're kind of combining both of those in this interview, where Rory Stewart, who's a UK-based politician, and Bob Geldof, like they discussed the interview. It's the Winter series, and you can Google it on YouTube. You'll find them. Yeah, maybe you could just give us a bit of background for like who they are and what was the discussion about.
Bob Geldof, as we all know, was a great musician, singer-songwriter of Boomtown Rats. And he then went into charitable work and ran loads of huge fundraising programs through Live Aid and all the amazing concerts that he did and the beautiful songs that he wrote. And he was very well-meaning and had a real soft spot for Africa, really wanted a lot of money coming into Africa. That was his dream. But I think somewhere along his path, he realized that in order to raise more money, he had to keep selling this sob story of Africa, of like, whoa, is Africa, it's so awful, everyone's dying, the whole thing is a disaster, you must give them more money. And I think he realized that wasn't a nice story to be selling people. That's not true either. There's some really amazing things about Africa that are going really well for them. And maybe some of the way the aid was being used wasn't good for them. So kind of, in a way, I think he decided that there were better routes to bringing money to Africa.
Well, my first memory of him is on the morning shows, Good Morning Britain, maybe, or one of those, on AM in the early days. And he'd be sitting there on the couch and he'd be swearing on TV, which was absolutely verboten, telling people to give me the effing money, which was totally, you know, gauche, the thing that made him stand out. But the only reason he got away with it was because he was kind of right. Like, he kind of called a lot of people out. Like, at the time, there was a famine going on in Ethiopia and we were all just sitting around doing nothing. You could argue sometimes the same thing's happening maybe today. And he was just so full of energy, and he's really kind of countercultural character, like a rock star, you know, not the sort of person you'd expect to get involved with charities. And he did this Live Aid thing, which was like defining. In my childhood was very defining, you know, because it was like a huge event. And it was the first time that something had really happened like that to, in a way, it was more, I saw it as empowering at the time. It was like a Live Aid was very cool and poverty was not cool before that. His take was, he didn't put out his hand and ask for money. He grabbed you by the shirt tie and he kind of said, listen, you owe us this money. You can't be a human and not give us the money. So give me the effing money. And I thought that was what made him stand out. And subsequently to that, you know, he went on, I think he was a very successful entrepreneur in media in the UK. He produced a number of shows for Channel 4 and others. And just a super energetic guy, but very counter-cultural. If you're Irish, he's sort of a hero, because in the 80s, there were no successful Irish people, more or less. Like, that was it. It was him, you know, and a load of corrupt politicians. So there was no other options. And then Rory Stewart, interesting, he's Scottish, and he is what you might consider a very conservative. Well, he is a conservative. He's a very conservative, upper class type of background. His dad was very high up in the civil service, I believe, in the Foreign Office, worked all around the world and very moved in very sort of rarefied circles, but had a very interesting worldview. So let's talk a little bit about what struck you most about their discussion, because they're both people who, you know, have tried to create good in the world and have somehow both come to this idea that the way to actually deliver good is, it's a juxtapose. On the one hand, Rory's attitude is just literally give them cash because they know best. And Bob's approach is, well, give them a job, you know, just give them a job rather than work through these big archaic programs that are oftentimes not very efficient. So what was your takeaway from their discussion?
I want to say as well that I think the relationship between Africa and the rest of the world is incredibly complicated money-wise, because really we do owe them an enormous, like, everlasting amount of cash for the sort of troubles that we've caused them over many, many years.
And you're talking about colonialism, et cetera, or
exactly.
Something else?
I mean, there's just so much reparation to be done there that you can't even begin to understand how much damage needs to be repaired. So I think the sort of aid is vital, that there has to be plenty of that happening anyway. And so I agree with Rory Stewart, so you give them cash, they should know what to do with it. That's part of it. But I also do think it's about listening to them, what they really want, and whether they want long-term sustainable jobs, whether they want to be, you know, more self-sufficient, with more agency, with more choice. And does having a job enable them to create the future that they want for themselves and their families? And maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but I think having both is really important. And something that was really inspiring about Bob Geldof's work is I think he just thought, I've got to now help reduce Africa's reliance on aid. I've got to help give them empowerment over dependency. I've got to kind of catalyze sustainable growth for the people. Yeah, he talks about how there's these two opposite ends of the spectrum, sizes of companies in Africa, the really large multinational corporates who kind of just control everything. And then there's all the small businesses who are maybe owned by one or two people, and they find it very difficult to grow outside of their small villages. And there's not much in between. And, you know, having seen what's happened in Western economies, is that often it's the faster growing mid-tier companies that are really expanding and creating jobs and developing relationships with all of their stakeholders and benefiting much wider than just the people that they employ. His view was, if I can invest into these mid-tier companies, then I can support them to create jobs and build a more sustainable future for people.
So let's do a bit of a primer here on a PE firm. He's created a PE firm. What is a PE firm?
I would say it's a firm that asks investors to put money into a big pot, and they will go after, I mean, it literally go after, because they hunt down businesses that are likely to create a lot of returns. And often there's quite a lot of competition for the good ones. So they find companies that are likely to grow well, have consistent revenue streams, are doing their job well as a business. And they say, look, we can bring you X amount of capital to expand beyond what you're doing at the moment. And if we give you that capital, you have to play by some of our rules. So we might ask you to fire a few people, and we might hire a few new people, and we might restructure this part of your business. And it's going to be painful, but the longer term thing is that you're going to be more profitable and you're going to be able to expand more. And, you know, normally there's a meeting with the existing investors in that business, where, you know, the investors will work out whether they think that the private equity firm is going to do a good job at helping their business expand. And yeah, private equity firms have been known for being really cutthroat, really scary, because they sort of can literally come into a business, rip everyone out, rip the whole structure out, replace it all with something completely new, and pretty much just use the brand to grow something that they're interested in. Private equity can have a really bad name for itself, but it can also support companies to grow. So it just depends on the way that it's done. And something that I've learned actually through working in investment banking, in wealth management, in social entrepreneurship, and with charities, is that the one kind of total game changer for me in terms of when I look at a business is when I can see that what they're really interested in is not just creating shareholder value for their investors, i.e. creating more profits and giving the profits to their investors, but they're really interested in what's called total stakeholder value. So that is looking after all of the stakeholders that are connected to that business. So that can be your customers, your suppliers, your employees, the communities that you're connected with, the local environment that you're connected with. And suddenly, when a business starts to really put loads of energy into all of their stakeholders and checking that all of their stakeholders are aligned on the business mission, those stakeholders start to give back. So they start to recognize, gosh, this business really cares about us. We really feel like they want to do a good job for all of us. Let's help market them. You know, if they grow, then they'll be the business that does well and they'll support us more. Employees, if they're looked after well, they stay for longer. It's, you know, it's beneficial for the business. I learned this from a really great organization called HR Maturity Institute. And they have just a fascinating way of analyzing the total stakeholder value of companies. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that business doesn't have to be take, 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 and give all the profits to shareholders. It can be about giving. And the more you give, the more you receive. And the business becomes a lot more sustainable in the long run because everyone trusts that they care.
So this hooks back a little bit to your experience in working in wealth management, where you've got to have something that looks like it's going to make a return, but then also can do some good along the way. Now, Bob's PE firm is called 8 Miles. Is that what they're attempting to offer that market of, you know, wealth funds, I guess? Who is their target, by the way? Could you or I go in the morning and put 100 quid into Bob's PE firm?
No, I don't know their exact amounts that they ask for, but I'm pretty sure it's very high. I think, you know, the first fund, I think, was 150 million. So I assume it would have been at least a million per investor that he was expecting to go in. Yeah, just understanding this concept of total stakeholder value, I think from Bob's background and his like understanding of how money and business affects everyone in the local community, like he has a really good grip on whether a business is likely to be kind of ethical and sustainable and have good governance and care about its stakeholders and whether it's going to last in the long term. Because the thing is, you know, if a business grows really fast over 5 years, but it's treated its employees like rubbish, it's destroyed the natural environment around it, it's probably somewhere along the line it's going to get some really bad press and then the whole thing's going to collapse. The importance of working in alignment with all the people that you're connected with just suddenly becomes really important. And I think as a result, yeah, he is interested in working with those longer term, more sustainable businesses.
There's a dissonance there between, I guess it maybe in the zeitgeist or maybe just in my head, which is, it seems like people who want to make the best return have to do the dirtiest job. We just have this feeling, like going back to those, you know, privately wealthy individuals you're working with, it feels like, you know what, there's probably a premium in investing in Philip Morris. Philip Morris is still around, you know, decades after the smoking ban, one of the biggest companies in the world still, which kind of shocked me still. But it feels like there's this idea that in order to get the best returns, and you're just looking at a line in a spreadsheet and you're a long way from the people and whatever, it's creating that story which gets people motivated. So do you think, Bob, do you think he's trying to do both? He's saying that, actually, you know what, I'll give you a reasonable return, better than the stock market. I guess that's what everyone's trying to do. But then you can sleep easier at night. What do you think their pitch is?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. I mean, that's 100% going to be selling the concept of supporting Africa. It is a sleep easy at night kind of model. And yeah, I think for me, where I see that his sales pitch attracts the sort of philanthropic type investor,
sure,
is that because of his background in charity, he really wants to give African people agency and possibilities, and he wants to listen to their expertise and drive positive change in the way that the locals want it and have a meaningful impact for people that live in Africa. And I think he also wants to sell the story of Africa being this like vibrant and resilient economic system that's ripe for building opportunities in. Of course, he's working with the systemic challenges that are there, but sort of helping the businesses to shape their own futures by using their own kind of local expertise. Yeah, I think it's about kind of harnessing what's already there in Africa and recognizing that they have a far deeper knowledge of what's needed than anyone who's coming from an outside country and trying to invest it into. And yeah, recognizing that, you know, only working with local partnerships and collaborations can you really foster kind of lasting change.
For a long time, I've said that, you know, we have a reasonable team in South Africa, and I've always called them my secret weapon because there's a lot of talent there, which is discounted a lot just because of the negative association, I feel like. I feel like if you think about the amazing people that come out of the continent, obviously Elon Musk is the archetypal, you know, billionaire success story, all the tech bros want to ape. But there's a lot of people there on my team. I can think of Mariska and, you know, Chris and Alandre and all the guys, really excellent people that you can't actually get access to necessarily anywhere else. I see the challenge with this idea of giving, like charity, giving people like stuff, is that it sets them in a sort of a weaker position and doesn't really respect their ability. Like, it's much better to go to someone and say, hey, you know, I want to go into business with you. We're going to do a deal, and I want you to be world-class. Just set the expectation that we have to be world-class. You're no longer, you know, competing with the people in your village or your street or your town or your country even. It's just straight to the top. And just setting that expectation, it's amazing the difference it has, right? So rather than sort of people expecting things from you, they realize, oh, this person's asking me to be world-class. And then just like that, the mindset changes from someone who is looking for something versus to someone who's delivering something. I got to deliver and compete at a world-class level. And that's the big change that's happened in the internet in the last few years in my business and so on. It has enabled that. And that's been interesting. So tell me a bit about yoga and safari. Safari and yoga, I got it wrong way around. So you've come from this arc where you've seen, okay, people are, you know, investing, but they're not necessarily making a difference in the world. Then you tried to work with, you know, entrepreneurs directly in Europe. And now what's brought you to sort of more direct action? This is kind of a more micro scale. You've kind of gone down the tree, right? So you started off very high, middle ground, and now you're just hands-on with a single business. Tell us about it.
It's a really good point. I hadn't thought about it like that, but I think what drives me is that if I can make a difference to one individual and the way they see the world and the way they feel about themselves, and if they can come on one of these trips and learn to be kinder and more compassionate to themselves and to others, then that automatically is going to trickle back into their businesses and what they do. And seeing that change is, yeah, to me, just way more meaningful than other work that I've been doing.
So what is Yoga and Safari? What is it, a 10-day trip, a one-day trip? How does it work? What's involved?
Once or twice a year, we have a 7-day experience that we take people on, which is going into the African wilderness. It's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime experience, staying in a beautiful, luxury-tented safari camp, all run exclusively by locals. And the guides are all local. So every trip is not just a gift to yourself going into this wilderness and seeing lions, leopards, hyenas, hippos, giraffe, everything. It's also a gift to conservation. It's a gift to the locals who receive these salaries and take them back to their communities. It's a sort of a two-way thing. The reason why the trip has yoga in it is because often we find when people come on these trips, they are really stressed. They've just been working incredibly hard, doing what they're doing. They've got incredibly buzzing, whirring minds that just are very hard to shut off. And as a result, it's very hard for them to be really present in the experience and really feel it for what it is and feel the change that kind of Africa gives you from within. So yoga can just bring us out of our minds into the body. We do a daily yoga practice before going out on game drives. And as a result, our whole senses are ignited and we get experience everything through the eyes of a child. So you just follow the lives of a family of cheetahs or a family of elephants, and you're much more with them and you're kind of questioning things much less and just recognizing the beauty of what is right in front of you and not needing to sort of name it in any way. And what often happens to people with that experience is that they drop into this heart-centered space and they recognize what's really important to them, whether it's their family, connection, being in nature more, you know, having more impact in the work that they do. And then that feeling that Africa sort of gifts them with, they can take home into their personal lives, into their family, and into their businesses. And the trickle effect is really beautiful. If they don't get any of that, then it's still an amazing experience just to be on safari, enjoying the animals, having a fun time in the wilderness. So that's just an additional bonus if that happens.
Okay, so it sounds like this is good for sort of type A individuals who are go, 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 maybe quite high achieving in their field. And they realize they need a complete mind break. They need something to shake them out of that, like a bit of a shock to the system and get them out of their own head.
Yeah, 100%. It takes a good sort of 4 days for people to wind down and come into presence in their body. And, you know, some people actually don't make it to wind down at all. Some people spend the whole week trying to wind down and have sort of just got there by the end and then go home. Yeah, there was one lady who literally had a buffalo walk over, start breathing very heavily right next to her tent, and then it lay on the side of her tent, which sort of bended inwards as it leant against, and then it slept there the whole night. So she could hear this breathing down her neck all night. Didn't sleep a wink, but she said it was a pretty unique experience, and it reminded her of how small she is in comparison to the kind of force of nature. And how in our minds, our life is so important. What we're doing is so important. We must uphold the identity that we are and achieve all the things that we're going to achieve in our life. But as soon as you're in expanse of the wilderness like that, you suddenly realize you're a visitor. You're like an insect in the wilderness, and the animals own the space, and you're just like tentatively coming in to have a look. It's a bit like going out to the middle of the sea and sort of looking around and realizing how small you are, or yeah, I mean, I imagine people who manage to get into space must get that when they look down to Earth.
So how can people find out more or reach out to you if they're interested in coming along on one of your journeys?
They can go to safariandyoga.com or safariandyoga handle on Instagram. And yeah, we have a couple of retreats coming up that you can sign up to, or we create bespoke experiences for people, for CEOs, for groups, for families. Guests that have come so far have just said it's been really healing, lots of special moments, life enhancing, many other brilliant testimonials from people. But I think it's something that most of us want to try and do at some point in our life is visit the wilderness in Africa.
Awesome. It's a beautiful website. So it's safariandyoga.com. Go and have a look at it. There are beautiful photography on the side. I'm looking at it now. As we wrap up, do you have a business hero, and who would it be?
I don't know if I have a specific business hero, but I do think that all of the people that I can think of that have been really inspiring to me have been people that have recognized they need to change something about themselves to be better in business. And so they've taken time off work to really do the work on themselves and to kind of transform and grow personally into a kinder, more compassionate person, and then bring that work back into their business. Yeah, I've seen just huge changes in people that have done that. I think the easiest way to do that, to be quite honest with you, is to just be a parent and be really, really present with your own child, because they will show you all of your shadows, all of your negative qualities. It's like staring yourself in the mirror every day. So I think I'm always really inspired with working parents who've taken some time off work to be really with their kids. It's so humbling, because just so much goes wrong and so much is out of your control. And it sort of reminds you that you're a small fish in a big pond. And then, yeah, bringing that kind of more humbled version of yourself back into business. Yeah. And it can be the same if you've cared for like an elderly person or a loved one. I think that can have that same kind of deep transformational effect. And I think there's a Rumi quote that says, "Yesterday I was clever and I tried to change the world. And today I am wise, so I'm changing myself." So I love that quote. And there's another one. Mother Teresa said, "Yeah, if you want to change the world, go home and love your family."
I love that. I think that's a lovely place to wrap up on. So listen, thank you very much. If you listened this far in the podcast, if you have a story about doing good as well as doing well, I'd love to talk to you here about how your business serves the community as well as your customers and yourself. So Lucy, thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you. Thanks, James. Great to be here.